Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rutt. And Marianne, we are anticipating Word Festival this coming weekend.
I am so excited. I'm booked. I can't do Saturday because it's my mum's 85th. Happy birthday, Mum. But I'm so excited. I'm booked out on Thursday, Friday and Sunday.
It's a full program. There's so many different things. There are choices to be made. But today I am talking to Charlotte Wood, the Australian writer who's coming over. She's going to be in three events. I highly recommend you go to those. I also recommend that you come to the session that I am chairing with Lawrence Fearnley and Damien Wilkins. I'm nervous about that because they're two writers that I am in awe of, but I know they will have a really profound conversation despite me. So
I'm sure that will be a wonderful session.
There's many more. I'm just highlighting that one. Anyway, we're also going to be talking with Claudia from Scorpio today, and she's going to be outlining all the various events that are going to be taking place at Scorpio over the next month. And as usual, again, jam-packed, lots of writers.
We're so lucky in Christchurch, aren't we, to have Scorpio providing that ongoing program of fabulous events to show up to. So thank you, Scorpio, and listen up to Claudia for the deets.
Exactly. And then I'm talking to a first-time writer, Jennifer Trevelyan, who's written a book that has been described as if you only read one book this year, make it this one. And it is pretty spectacular. She's been endorsed by a huge number of big names. And yesterday, Jacinda Ardern actually recommended that you read this book.
So there you have it.
We
were expecting that one to suddenly maybe take over Jacinda's spot as on the top of the book sales list.
Throw her off. Australian novelist Charlotte Wood will be appearing at Word Christchurch this week and will be a hugely welcome visitor. Her latest novel, Stoneyard Devotional, was shortlisted for last year's Booker Prize and has been widely read and greatly discussed. It's a real privilege to talk with you, Charlotte, before your visit. And congratulations on how well this book has done.
Thank you so much, Maureen. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to come to Christchurch. I've never been, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, we're hoping to turn up the temperature knobs for you so you won't freeze. This book, you were saying just before we went on air, you're not sure where it came from, but it came at a specific time in your life where things were happening for you.
Yes, it came out of some strange sort of sequence of events and times, I suppose. I started writing it during our pandemic lockdowns, and that was a very strange time for all of us, as we know, a time when I felt that all our certainties about the world had been suddenly ripped away, that we'd been sort of, as a culture, I suppose, going around thinking, well, we know everything, we know what's going to happen, how it's going to happen, we can plan our lives, and then suddenly all that was gone. And we had no certainty about anything. And in Australia, the pandemic, the sort of start of the pandemic came immediately after the worst bushfires that we've ever had, these terrible months of, shocking fires and smoke. And even in the city, we were just enveloped in this thick smoke. not to mention all the terrible catastrophic environmental destruction. So the fires happened, then the pandemic happened, and then that was sort of, you know, starting to settle down, and we had incredible, terrible floods here. During the pandemic, there was a very serious mouse plague, which worked its way into the book. So there were these kind of rolling catastrophes, I suppose, that felt very epic, and they felt almost biblical in their scale. And then I'd written the first draft of the book, and my sister was discovered to have breast cancer, and then within 6 weeks I was diagnosed with breast cancer and our younger sister at the same time. So this was another kind of sort of more personal catastrophe, it felt like. We're all fine now, and we were very lucky to have, you know, the most treatable form. But psychologically, that was just, you know, it was like, I think I've said before, it's like being in a washing machine of just chaos and fear and never knowing what the hell is happening, you know. So in the middle of all these sort of epic scale events, this book sort of started to form itself. And I think in response to a lot of that, really, the kind of, you know, the response to this sort of chaos is to, for me, often to just retreat and go very quiet and very still. And, you know, and that's kind of what the book is about, really, the ethics of engaging with the world versus withdrawing from the world and the kind of tension involved in that.
Because I've seen it described as a quiet book, and I wanted to ask you about that, because for a very personal reason that I may or may not go into, because it doesn't matter really, but the description of it as a quiet book kind of belies what's going on under the surface, doesn't it?
Thank you for saying that. Yes. I mean, it's such a weird term, a quiet book. And in, you know, in publishing world, it's kind of, you know, like a death thing. It's like, oh, well, it's lovely, but it's a quiet book, you know, as if it's, you know, a sort of funereal idea. Personally, as a reader, they're the books that I love the most, the books that are described as quiet. And I love them because mostly they are more about depth than about speed, you know, and the idea of this sort of event and happening and speed and turnover and all of that is kind of what the people in the book are trying to avoid. So the book itself enacts this this desire to just settle quietly and think and sort of, I'm making sort of yes, plant root gestures with my hands, sinking down deep into the earth. And, you know, writers that I love, like Elizabeth Strout or and recently Deborah Levy, Anne Enright, these people write books, I mean, Virginia Woolf, you know, that are not about a racy plot. And actually, amusingly, I was saying to my publisher at one point, you know, I find it weird also that people say, oh, nothing happens in this book. I've got, you know, there's a dead body in the front room for starters. There's, you know, a visitor from the past. There's this mouse plague that's quite relentless. Anyway, we were kind of laughing about that. And she said, look, for some people, if it's not on fire, they can't see it. And that made me laugh. And I think that's true. This is not a book for those sort of people. But strangely, it's the book that I've had the most intense responses to, you know, from readers and you know, and the Booker Prize shortlisting and all of that. It's sometimes surprising how much a so-called quiet book can do and how people really connect with it. So I don't know, it doesn't bother me, the word quiet. I just think, I don't know, I like quiet people too, you know. To me, it equates with thoughtfulness, and that's a good thing.
Yes. Actually, I was telling myself I mustn't just say yes when people answer my question, but in this case, I kind of feel I have to say yes because that's a brilliant answer to the question. It is those kind of books that I like. I want to go down. I want to be provoked. I want to be left with thoughts of what it would mean to me. I think those are the books that really resonate with people, because a plot-driven book, it's over, you've shut the book and it's you're reaching for the next one.
I think it's quite thrilling to have a well-written, plot-driven book. But for me as a reader, it also has to have this sort of depth, you know, it's got to have some gravitas underneath it. I heard an interview with Anne Enright, who's a writer I absolutely love, and she said that as a reader, she likes a book where she's reading away and then every so often she just lays the book in her lap and sort of looks up into the air for a moment, because it's made her think of something about her own life or, you know, about something else. And I agree with that. I love those books that give you space to give you pause as well, you know. And I think, you know, one of the reasons maybe this book has done well at the moment is that our world is so full of kind of horror stories that that are plowed into us through the media daily, and it's the idea of just taking pause from this onslaught of suffering, really, that we see, is just being able to breathe and settle and think for a moment is very appealing to me anyway.
So in the book, the unnamed narrator, and there's good reasons why she is not given a name, but she goes back to her birthplace, where she grew up, which is where you grew up. So it's familiar territory for you. But she goes to this community of nuns, and they're not the silent ones. That would be pretty tricky. But they're an unusual cluster of women who've gone there for various reasons. So she is given all this space and time, and because she's in her own, she's in familiar territory, it's bringing back all those memories, isn't it, of her relationship with her parents, people that she knows in the district, some of whom are still there and aren't. So it's rich pickings, really.
Yes, it's sort of, you know, she's an atheist, and she ends up sort of almost stumbling into this monastery. It's not in the town where she grew up, but it's nearby. And she's basically, as someone put it to me, unsubscribed from her life. She's been an environmental activist in the city. She's married. She's working, running this center for the Threatened Species Rescue Center. And she's hit a wall of despair, because she realizes, you know, well, everything I've done as an activist has comprehensively failed, and she just sort of can't go on with that anymore, and she just sort of leaves. And, you know, she doesn't think she's going to stay in this place. She thinks they're all pretty weird, and she also thinks, well, it's all very well for these women to sit around here singing their little songs and praying and whatever, but what good is that doing in the world, you know? And she leaves, but then there's a kind of a break of turning a page, and then we discover, oh, she's living here now. She's been living here for 4 years. And she never really joins up properly. She never becomes a nun. She never actually does find a belief in God, but they just let her stay there. And she becomes part of this community, and she does come to respect these women, or some of them anyway. Some of them drive her completely crazy. She can't stand them. But she realizes that, well, by staying here and sort of doing nothing, they're not hurting anybody. They're not hurting the planet. They're not hurting other people. They're not trying to bring anyone to their cause. They're just doing no harm. And she sort of comes to understand, well, maybe they've done more good for the world than I have ever done with all my, you know, activism and pushing and, you know, engaging. But then that is also that position, she's sort of tussles with that the whole book. And one of the things that confronts her about it is the arrival of this woman called Sister Helen Parry, who is a full-on activist nun. And there are these women around the world, these sort of, you know, I call them rogue nuns, where they're troublemakers. They're political activists, they're environmental activists. They, you know, cause ructions in the name of getting justice for people who can't speak for themselves and so on. So this woman turns up, and it turns out they have known each other in the past in a uncomfortable way. And so Helen Parry brings with her all the energy of this outside world activism that the women in this place have deliberately left behind. So it's a big culture clash that, you know, and there is the COVID pandemic going on outside in the background. There's travel restrictions. Helen Parry can't leave. She doesn't want to be there. They don't want her there. You know, so there is this sort of tension, and I suppose she and the narrator are kind of embodying these two, well, she and the other women there embodying the two ends of the spectrum of, you know, action is the antidote to despair, or first do no harm. And there's really no resolution of which of those is the better end to be on the spectrum.
Well, I'm guessing, you know, none of us know the answer to that question. So it would have been for you to end the book with some kind of, you know, strong position would have been impossible as a writer.
And I think that's one of the things about growing older, you know, is that you do lose the kind of certainties of youth. And one of the first interviews I did about this book was with a young woman, a journalist, and I, you know, brought up this thing of these two mantras, first do no harm and action is the antidote to despair. And she said, well, which one's right? And I said, I don't know. She looked kind of stricken, you know, because she wanted to know. And I said, yeah, I want to know too, but I'm not going to. And I think, you know, one of the things I've come to kind of value as I feel like I'm still growing up, even though I'm actually growing old now, but about that is the ability to hold two opposite ideas at the same time without, you know, going crazy. It's that opposite things can be true at once. And we just have to live in that space between those opposites and kind of every day, every hour, almost work out what's the best thing right now for me to do, ethically speaking.
Yeah, it's quite scary to be with people who are so adamant that their point of view is right. That scares me more than anything often. Now, at our festival, you are going to be doing a session with Emily Perkins. You're going to be having a discussion. And I think those sessions are often the most enlightening because you two know what you're talking about.
I love Emily. She's a friend of mine. We've been doing some teaching together lately. And actually we're doing two things at the festival. We're doing a conversation about my book, but we're also running a workshop together on the Saturday, a kind of Q&A thing about anything to do with writing or fiction. So that'll be fun. But Emily, I met Emily in Australia at a festival years ago, and I just absolutely fell in love with her writing. And then we became friends. I think she's so smart and funny, and you know, she really brings something to conversations about writing that I find so energizing and fresh. And yeah, we're going to have fun.
Yeah, well, for audience members, it's like you're given this privilege of eavesdropping on a quite, you know, in-depth conversation between two people who respect each other's work but know the right kind of questions to ask each other.
Yeah, I think Emily and I have a kind of enough simpatico in the ways that we work to kind of find common ground, but also we do work quite differently at times as well, or kind of I've learned so much from her in doing this course, Elements of Fiction, that we've been running. And, you know, every time she speaks, I feel like I need my notebook with me to just, you know, start taking lessons.
Well, I'm pretty sure she'd say the same thing about you, Charlotte. So that's what will be so great about these two sessions.
I'm also on a panel wonderfully with Catherine Chidji and Michelle Duff the chairperson's name, but it's about atmosphere, creating atmosphere in fiction. So that will also be excellent fun.
Won't it? Now, I hope that, and I'm sure that you're being shortlisted for the Booker has led people to your other books, because I've just had the joy of reading The Weekend and The Natural Way of Things, and that gives you insights into your latest book, or into what, you know, what has motivated you to write some quite different books, really.
Yes, I kind of like, each book seems inside me to be a reaction against the previous one. You know, I just want a complete change of scene or change of tack. So they are quite different, I think. Although, you know, people tell me over the years about these preoccupations keep coming up, and I see that, you know, that's why having readers is so great, because they tell you what you've done. But yeah, they're re-releasing quite a few of my old books now in the UK and America and Australia and New Zealand. They're having a lot of editions of the older books, so that's very nice.
Yeah, because, you know, once you discover through something like a Booker Prize or some other kind of award or prize, it's really such a pleasure to go back and find the earlier books.
I love that. I know Sigrid Nunez is another writer I really love, and I read her book The Friend, which has recently been made into a movie. And that, I think, won some prize in the States, and I'd never heard of her. And as soon as I read that, I had that feeling of, I need everything this woman's ever done. So luckily there were sort of, I think, four or five or six previous books that I could run off and order. I love that feeling that there's a whole treasure trove of work that you've, you know, never seen before.
Exactly. Well, we, as I say, we're really looking forward to having you here. If people are listening and want to get tickets, go on the website and find out if there are tickets still available. And I will be in the audience for at least two of those, so it will be a real pleasure to listen to you.
Well, thank you, Maureen. I hope we get to meet in person. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
My pleasure. The book is Stoneyard Devotional. It's written by Charlotte Wood, and it's published by Allen and Unwin.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Well, it's time to welcome and say kia ora to Claudia Hertz-Jardine in from Scorpio to tell us what's going to be happening at the bookshop over the next month.
Hello, Maureen. Well, it's looking like a cracking spring for new books in Ōtautahi Christchurch. You will probably know the word program is out there. There's lots of talk about it, lots of buzz. The theme is joy. And on that note, we are overjoyed to be launching the second Violet and the Velvets book by local author Rachel King on the 28th of August. So the usual 5:30 p.m. for a 6 o'clock start. This is middle grade reading aimed at ages sort of 7 and up. They're beautiful books. They're fun. They've got illustrations. Violet is a punky little 12-year-old in a band, and in this book, her band has made it to the finals of Band Champs. And they're facing their rivals, they're on the stage, but then things start to go slightly awry. So the age range is for your early reader heading into probably a few years away from young adult, lots of fun. And the event will be the beginning of the Word Festival week, so it'd be a nice way to meet some writers who've come in from out of town, have a glass of wine and a mix and a mingle, and celebrate Rachel King, which we're very excited to do.
Yeah, I'll be there. Definitely.
I see you're on the RSVP list. Yes, yep. Very good.
I'm getting in early.
Yes.
I want to be one of those old people in the chairs at the front.
Yes. Yeah, you got to be. The nice comfortable ones, yeah, that come out of the history department. Yeah. And Rachel will be chairing another session in the festival on Sunday the 31st with also another local writer, Rachel Craw, and Andrea Eames, who's coming over from the US.
Yeah, we had Rachel on the program last week. So right up with the play here, and I loved the first Violet and the Velvets book. Is there music to go with it?
I believe there is. I think there's another playlist on the way, and I think Rachel has also been making merch lately too. I've seen T-shirts and things around.
Brilliant.
And then for your post-word blues, inevitable, the wee post-word dip, on Tuesday the 2nd of September, we have our books club in store. So these sessions are $10 a ticket. You pay on the night. The book that will be up for discussion is Beautyland by Marie-Hélène Bertino. Some of our staff have been raving about this. It's a four-year-old girl. Her mum installs a fax machine in her bedroom because there's nowhere else in the house to fit it. And then the fax machine starts receiving faxes from aliens. And the four-year-old starts to acquire quite interesting skills rather quickly, I think with the idea that the aliens want the child to sort of spy on human race. It sounds fantastic and a bit weird and kooky, and it's funny, sort of dark comedy. I haven't read it yet. I'm looking forward to it, though. And it's not too big a read, so you could probably cram it in between all of your word favourites.
I think you could. You always need a book in your handbag or whatever bag you carry when you're at Word for those sort of half an hour between.
Yeah, you're running around, yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. So this one could be your go-to.
It's nice and light, yeah. It'll get you there. And, you know, it'll be a great chance to come into the shop, have a wee debrief. Lots of the book club regulars also crazy about Word, and I'm sure there'll be lots of discussion going on. They're all raving about the Catherine Chidgey session, naturally. We had Book of Guilt as Book of the Month a few months ago.
Well, they should be raving about the session I'm doing with Damien Wilkins and Lawrence Fernley.
Yes.
Because apart from the fact that I'm chairing it, I will be handing it over to those two great intellects to discuss their books together. So please come to that.
Indeed. And they were both also Book of the Month last year, I think, at Scorpio. I loved hearing Lawrence talk about the fact that she doesn't write for plot. You know, she's like, I don't care about that. You know, I'm in it for the characters.
She is, you could never anticipate exactly what Lawrence is going to say.
Yeah.
She's the most original mind.
Indeed, yes. And then heading into the 4th of September, we are hosting a BWB talk. This is Bridget Williams Books, the renowned academic publishers. We love them. We really rate everything that they create. I've just finished reading Slowing the Sun by Nadine Ann Hooder. Loved that book. Fantastic essay collection. And on the 4th of September, we will be hosting Professor Sean Hendy in conversation with Rebecca McPhee to talk about the COVID response. You might have heard in the news this week about some of the opposition leaders skipping out on the COVID, inquisition. Is that the right word? Inquest.
Well, I think that's a Freudian slip that is entirely accurate.
Yeah.
Freudian.
Mm. So that should be really interesting. And unfortunately for the locals, it is the same night as the mayoral debate. So some tough choices to be had. But I'm sure Sean...
Well, my choice would definitely be to listen to Sean. I remember interviewing him years ago and being so impressed. He's won prizes for his science communication and media, the Prime Minister's science back in the day when the Prime Minister gave out science media communication prizes. He's a very clear thinker and he was essential to our understanding what was going on during COVID. So this should be a really great book. And talking with Rebecca McPhee, another of my people that I have a huge amount of respect for.
Yeah, she everything she articulates very well. Yeah, we're a big fan of Rebecca. So that'll be us on the 4th of September. Heading into later on in September, we have a few events lined up for that first week of the school holidays. A slightly different offering we're doing on the 25th of September, that's a Thursday in the school holidays at 10 a.m. We're going to have Jessica Ehrlich in the main Scorpio bookstore. You might know Jessica as a poet. She's quite famous on Instagram. She writes a lot about motherhood, and she's written books for children, and she's written poems for the sort of adult market. And she has a new gift book coming out called May You Always Know. And it's really closely, it's launching, well, we're sort of having like, it's not quite your standard evening book launch at Scorpio. It's going to be a daytime affair. There'll be activities for the kids because she's also had two new children's titles out this year. And there will also be some chat and Q&A with Jessica about her work more for the adults. So it'll be sort of like the adults at the back of the shop chatting with the author. And then we've got a little station set up for the kids with crafts and kindness activities. So.
What a busy woman.
Indeed.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. And then just to round it off, on the 27th of September at Little Andromeda, 8:30 p.m, the second collection of short stories from local author Laura Borodale, also an editor of Ngā Puka Puka Peka Peka. Laura's coming out with Dead Ends, published by Tender Press. And this is classic Laura. It's going to be dark. It's going to be sexy. It'll be savage. The book cover looks fantastic. We're really excited to get our hands on the advanced reading copy. And I had the pleasure of being in a writing group with Laura, so I've seen a few of the pieces sort of in progress, and that's going to be a lot of fun. I imagine, knowing Laura, it will be the event at Little Andromeda will be a bit theatrical. There'll be some...
Just a touch.
Yeah. Yes. A bit of dynamism coming.
Exactly. Some very high heels and long legs. I will be looking forward to that copy too and to talking to Laura. And just quickly, two picks for Word. What are you most excited about? I'm only giving you two picks.
Oh, only two.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about Kate DeGoldie with this Eden Hoare event. I think that book is fantastic. The story is... I mean, who would have thought,
outrageous.
You know, and the photographs and the clothing, it's incredible. And I mean, Kate's a great speaker. I'm sure it's going to be a roaring ride.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Yeah.
Gosh. Tick, 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 tick. Here.
And I mean, I want to talk about one of the ones that I'm in because I'm currently working on my presentation and I'm getting really deep in the rabbit hole. I'm doing This Bank Could Be Your Life with Damien Wilkins and Brandon McNamara-Lingham, and there's two other speakers as well. We're all talking about a favorite band or musician. I feel like I can let you know. I'm going to be talking about SZA, the hip hop and R&B artist, huge star. But at the heart of all of her music, she's a real person with insecurities and anxieties. So I'll be diving into
how 21st century is that. Well, great. I will look forward to seeing you there. I hope everybody's listening who can come to Word comes. And even if you're out of town, you know, think about coming to Christchurch, Door to Tahi. Give it a whirl. Thank you so much, Claudia, and thank you to Scorpio for sponsoring us and for putting on so much good stuff.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Jennifer Trevelyan's first book, A Beautiful Family, has had a dream run since it was published. Rave reviews here and overseas, accolades from high-profile writers, critics, and even yesterday Jacinda Ardern recommended that we all read the book. But this book was a long time in the making, and... there's two kind of separate stories going on here, aren't there, Jennifer?
Yes.
The you know, what's happened since it's been published and then the long birth of this book. So yep. Tell us a bit about that.
Sure. Well, this book probably didn't exactly take me that long to write, but it was a long process of writing other novels before getting onto this one. And those other novels went into a drawer because I was just teaching myself how to write novels. And then when I finished this one, or finished it up to that point, I thought maybe it wasn't good enough either and put it into the drawer. So it sat there for about 3 years while I continued with my writing, and I did an MA at Victoria University. And then I got it out of the drawer and had a look at it and thought, yeah, it's not too bad. And I went from there submitting it, and it was picked up really quickly. So that's what you're referring to really with the two stories. It was a slow burn on my side, but then once it made it out into the world, it was pretty quick.
Yes, there was a bidding war, wasn't there, once your agent got hold of it?
Yeah. There was. Yes, there was a lot of interest, which was incredible and really just mind-blowing and quite daunting to navigate, but wonderful as well, of course, to have that kind of choice after so long thinking, will I ever get published?
Absolutely. And then film rights taken up by Nikki Caro.
Yes, yeah. She read the book very early on and just loved it. And we met over Zoom, and I felt she got it completely. You know, we're not dissimilar ages, and she knows the Kapiti Coast, and I just knew I could totally trust her with it. I think she'll do a great job. Yeah, it'll be really exciting to see.
Well, we better talk about the book, because there is plenty to talk about. Hard to know where to start, but I think we need to start with Alex, who tells the story, who's 10.
Yes.
And she's telling the story in the past tense. So we know there's a bit of a remove from when all the events happened over the summer at the beach. But she's still seeing it through a 10-year-old's eyes.
Yes, she is, yes. That was an interesting thing to balance. I didn't want to write a whole novel using a 10-year-old's vocabulary. I thought that could be very frustrating and limiting, but I did want to write in the spirit of a 10-year-old. So in my mind, she is writing from a later point in her life, looking back and trying to piece together the events of the summer. I imagine that a lot of what has happened has been swept under the carpet, and she's trying to figure out what is real and what is not. And so, yes, and she can only look at it through her own 10-year-old eyes, because that's all she has to go by. So that's what I was sort of trying to capture, and it was a lot of fun but quite challenging in places.
Yes, it must have been. You've got to keep your adult understandings to one side, don't you?
And I had to keep asking myself, is that a thought process that a 10-year-old would have? Luckily, I was, at the time my children were around that age, I have a boy and a girl, and they were sort of 9 and 11 or something like that. So I was listening to them talking all the time, and I was getting, and also hearing about what they were reading, and I was getting a feel for how they saw the world. So that was really helpful as well. I didn't just have to try and remember. I could see it every day.
But you've set it back in the 80s. So in a sense, you know, your children have a whole lot of other things going on in their lives, digital things. And
well, right, although we were quite strict about that. But yes, I'm certainly also comparing that in my head as well, as you do as a mother. You look back at your own childhood and compare. And I do think we were very lucky. I do think that it was just an amazing time, a lot of freedom, a lot of boredom as well, but I think that boredom can be very productive. And I was a big reader, a daydreamer, and I just loved being on the beach, loved swimming.
Well, that comes through because Alex and her family go up to the Kapiti Coast.
Yes.
And it's an unusual choice for them to go there. So there's unsettling things happening right from the start, aren't there?
Yes, that's right. Well, the Kapiti Coast was very packed, really, when we used to go there. And I had the more of the kind of summer that Kahu in the book has, where I had an extended family there and lots of aunts and uncles and cousins. But Alex is used to having holidays in more remote places. And then out of the blue, her mother suggests this place, which is quite crowded with people from Wellington having their summer holiday. And that does pique Alex's interest. She thinks, why is that? And I won't give away any spoilers.
No, because this book is, well, it's a lot of things. It's an exploration of a 10-year-old girl's view of the world and the summer holidays and what goes on in them. But there's also a real thriller aspect to it, because from the moment they get there, you pick up all the unease that's going on. And as an adult, you keep thinking something's going to happen, but who's it going to happen to? And who's going to be the person that, there's a creepy man behind them. Is he going to be the one that is uncovered? There's the death of a 9-year-old child some years before. There's so many things. So many, roads we could go down.
That's right. And I think when I started writing the book, I roughly knew what road it was going to go down. I think the setting really demanded, I felt, a suspense novel, because it's such a beautiful setting, but it is also so wild and potentially dangerous. And I think I was very aware of that as a child. My mother was one of those mothers that was pretty nervous about beaches and swimming and letting us roam around. Mind you, I think we did. But I was always aware of the danger, and that kind of heightened the excitement of it all, I think. So I thought the setting dictated in many ways what kind of book it was going to be. But I was definitely figuring out the plot as I went along. I don't like to know for certain where it's going to go, because that sort of spoils the adventure for me as well in writing it. So there's often a point I reach in writing a novel where I have to stop and take a little break and figure out where it's going. And then sometimes you have to go back and make edits. So it's not a very efficient process, but it makes it more exciting for me.
There are, as I say, so many avenues, roads, whatever you want to call them, because you set up all these dangerous things. As you say, the beach itself is a danger. Mm-hmm. There's a lagoon nearby, you know, and one that's a bit rancid. And
I made the lagoon sound a lot worse than it really was, I think. I did row on that lagoon in the 80s. It wasn't too bad, but you might not have wanted to jump in either.
No, there was no hidden depth.
Bottom, yeah.
And the fact that children back in those days could roam without too much, nowadays we're also terrified of stranger danger, but back then there was a lot more roaming going on. But you know, contemporary readers are all the time thinking, oh, well, this is all going to end in disaster, these children. But the relationships are so important in this novel as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I was interested in exploring.
Yeah. Alex has a older teenage sister who's on the brink of going wild. She comes across this lovely friend, Kahu. He was a total delight.
He is a delight, isn't he? Yeah, yeah. I think he's loosely based on my best friend growing up, a girl actually who left New Zealand when we were about 12, and it was a real blow. I remember it was devastating, and I think I poured a lot of that into that friendship and that character, and the way. In the 80s, you could lose touch with someone, and really that was it. You couldn't find them. There was no social media. Unless you did become pen pals, that was it. So I loved writing Kahu, and everybody loves him. Everybody seems to love him, yeah.
Yeah, well, they have adventures together. They're following, they're pursuing, trying to get to the bottom of the disappearance of this young girl who's round about their age when she goes missing. It's a holiday mystery that is just absorbing them.
Yes.
But then, of course, she's observing her parents doing strange, not strange things, but, you know, out of character things and trying to work out what's going on there.
Yes, I think she's just at that age where she's starting to realise that her parents aren't perfect and that she can't necessarily trust everything they say. And at the same time, she's watching her sister sort of get into dangerous situations, and I think that's extremely stressful for Alex. And I think really she just wants to hold them all together, but she can't. You know, she's got no control over really anything, which is pretty terrifying for her. So the stuff she's doing with Kahu, although it's actually probably the most dangerous stuff, is just fun for her. But what's going on at home is what really scares her.
Yeah. Kahu is a constant. She knows that he's going to be waiting somewhere on the beach, or they're going to link up and they're just going to have a day of pottering and following clues and just being pals, really, just good friends, mates. Mm-hmm. But, yes, everything else. You have got a tremendously good memory for what it feels like to be a teenage girl reading 17 and getting cheap makeup from the chemist and meeting boys at the surf club.
I seem to have a great long-term memory and a hopeless short-term one. And my husband is the opposite, so we fill in the gaps. But, it's a time that was really very, it just sort of seared into my memory. It was a fantastic summer. I do remember 1985. I remember that place that we stayed at. I was very excited by all the possibilities out there. The great movies and music of the time were very inspiring to me and still are. And it was just a moment that I knew would make good fiction.
Yes, you've captured it, as I say, extremely well. Alex has her favourite tape of Split Ends that she and her Walkman, her red Walkman.
It's great music. I'm not sure I did at 10, but yeah, but I did have a bright red Walkman that I just cherished. And we each had one. We were very lucky, and we all walked around the beach house singing different lyrics at the top of our lungs to different songs.
It's certainly struck a chord with so many people. And I think, you know, we're not unusual as a country in having those beach spots that we all went to. I mean, we sound very privileged, don't we, that we were able to go and have these adventures in these particular spots.
Mm. Yeah, you could back then, and it's much harder now, I think. But it's interesting, the reception overseas, because people in Britain and America are really connecting with the story and seem to find it very familiar as well. So it's interesting, because you write a book that seems so quintessentially New Zealand, but it actually is quite universal in its themes, I suppose.
So a next book for you, Jennifer, is it too early to, are you one of those writers who likes to keep?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm a bit lost if I'm not writing. And it has been a while, you know, traditional publishing is quite slow, so I've actually had quite a while. And the next one is quite a long way along. So fingers crossed it will make its way out into the world. I'm hoping that this first book wasn't a fluke, but we'll see. Yeah, it's another suspense novel.
Good. Was it, just harking back to you going to the IIML and doing your MA?
Yes.
I gathered from what you said that this wasn't necessarily the manuscript that you took?
No, it wasn't. No, I did something else in the MA. I don't know exactly why. It is a very tight, quite high-pressure situation. You really only have 8 months to write a novel, and I decided at the beginning of that year that I just wanted to write something not dark. I didn't want to write something dark. I just felt a bit exhausted by that, and I wrote something completely different. And it was fun. It was interesting. At the moment, it's in the drawer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess all the feedback that you had from that, which is, you know, the major reason people do courses like that, so yeah, they can workshop it with other people, that would have fed into your book and future books.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was very reassuring to have been through that process when I went then subsequently went through the process of editing A Beautiful Family and getting feedback from various editors. I think that would have been very stressful and daunting if I hadn't had the MA behind me, because you do learn how to deal with feedback and how to respond to it. So that was a really good experience. And it also just taught me that the work is really hard and you need to take it seriously and give it a chance. You know, I might have left that book in the drawer if I'd never done the MA. Yeah.
Well, we will look forward to the next one.
Oh, thank you.
And congratulations on this whole process. I guess the success of this book and how widely read it has been and it will be. And we can only look forward to what Nikki Caro is going to do with it as well.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. No, it's been a fantastic experience. I'm very lucky. And yeah, I'll be excited to see the adaptation for sure.
Thank you for your time, Jennifer, and for all the work that you've put into this book. It's called A Beautiful Family. It is by Jennifer Trevelyan, and it's published by Allen and Unwin. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.